You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
That's correct. You're tuned into Audio Culture on 95BFM. We have a very special segment ahead of us today. I'm joined by Dr. Sharon McIver on the airwaves. Kia ora, Sharon. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me. It feels like a very special time as festival season kind of dawns upon us to do a little bit of a deeper reflection on what it all means.
Excellent.
We're going to talk a little bit about your thesis, Wave Shape Conversion, The Land as Reverent in the Dance Culture and Music of Aotearoa, which was originally published in 2007. Do you want to give us a little, I hate to try and get you to condense your beautiful thesis into a short blurb, but for anyone who's not quite familiar with it, could you give us a little bit of context?
Well, basically I spent just under 7 years travelling around the country and going to, mostly Te Waipounamu, but I did do some Te Ekoa Maui gigs as well. But I basically went to over 60 dance events and researched them, and I was specifically looking at how Aotearoa New Zealand dance music, electronic dance music, is also, you can hear the landscape in it. And so it was quite important because a lot of those events that were happening at the time were also happening in sort of rural areas. So the landscape became important on the practical level of actually being at the event, but also being able to hear it into the music as well.
I mean, it feels like we were saying before, at the beginning of a festival season when we all start planning our trips away, it feels important to take a moment to think about the land that we're on and how that relates to the experience of a festival and how we can appreciate both the music and the land and the people that we're with.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, it was sort of, I always called it my road to Damascus moment, because I was raised quite Christian. And then during my 20s, I sort of was a little bit, I'd left the church and didn't really believe in anything. And then sort of, I think I started the thesis when I was in my early 30s. And just the sensation of being out in those, and I'd never really been I was such a city kid, I'd never gone out camping much, and suddenly being in those spaces with all those people and the music playing, and there's nothing quite like a moon popping up over the hill and the dance floor going off and the music kind of locking into that as well. It was just a real incredible spiritual experience for me as well.
And I feel like that's something that's more and more embraced by festivals as well. I mean, I think of festivals in the South Island that feel very spiritual, and I immediately think Twisted Frequency.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to admit, I've sort of haven't really gone to very many since I finished, partly because all of my cohorts are a bit older too, and it sort of takes us a bit more effort to get out for a weekend festival these days.
You're not a raver still?
No, not really. I haven't been to Twisted for, I'm in my late 50s now, and it's just all a little bit kind of a bit of a mission compared to what it was when I was actually living in a van and, could just drop everything and go, I'm off for 5 days to hang out at the top of a hill and help work at a festival. And so I think somewhere along the line, a lot of them got really commercialized. I know that that's changing now, and festivals like Synchronicity and Twisted Frequency are changing that back, which is great. But I think because so much of what I did was involved with like the massive crew and Or Te Tahi Christchurch, and it was such a whānau-based thing. And, I just don't really have the friendship group now that necessarily want to pack in and get to a festival, and it takes a lot of energy. And I think too, because I spent 10 years after I finished my PhD, I ran a recycling and event sort of waste consultancy called Our Daily Waste. And so a lot of events I went to, I was running a team of people, and we were actually physically going through rubbish bins and hand sorting everything to get as much diverted and and let's just say it might take me a wee while before I want to go back to festivals and
so, fair enough.
I'm keen. I nearly got to Synchronicity, the one that was on, and got snowed out. So it gets to join the Rainy Gathering and the Windy Destination. Now we've got the Snowy Synchronicity. I nearly got to that as a volunteer, and then the crew I was going to work for, it fell through. And then on the day when I sort of looked at the weather a couple of days before, I went, oh my God, it's going to be like 2 degrees. And, you know, I'm a little bit out of practice for doing the freezing cold parties, to be honest.
Yeah, I feel that, you know, what you talked about before about a lot of the festivals becoming a lot more commercialized solidifies the importance of your thesis and these sort of discussions around how we protect our people and culture and land as we go about enjoying music. And I don't know, do you think that we're having enough of those conversations?
I don't know that we ever had enough of those conversations. I mean, back in the day, I think a lot of the land, there was a real shift that started to happen in the 2000s when I was researching, where, you know, Kaikoura Roots and Destination would do, would get local hapu to come and do welcomes and things like that, to do a porphyry. And that was really good to see that shift, that, you know, we weren't just dancing on land, we were being respectful, we were starting to make those connections to tangata whenua and think about that, and particularly the Parihaka Festival, which of course was held at the Parihaka Pa. And I remember, you know, being welcomed on, and oh, the Pākehā guilt I felt of walking up that road, knowing that, you know, the constabulary had walked up there and you know, done what they did in 1881, I think it was, and I had that real sort of sense of, wow, this changes everything. And I knew that it had just added extra time to my thesis as well, because suddenly, because of the Parihaka Festival, I then had to look at more deeply, go into Te Tiriti or Waitangi, and look at our colonisation history. And so it added quite a lot of extra time, because I wasn't really planning to look at that originally, but then when Parihaka came along and I just went, oh my God, I really have to look at this. And I think that was around about the time that there was an awareness building amongst dance culture as well. Although I think the gatherings and the entrain parties, they, you know, where possible, I know a lot of the organisers did try to liaise as much with local Māori as they possibly could. And yeah, but I, you know, it's a tough one. I know that a lot of the events that we held with massive parties were on, you know, local farmland. And I believe that, you know, donations would be made to the local school so that people didn't complain about the noise. And so, you know, getting those kind of community things, I think we were lucky in terms of, you know, when you look at what happened in the United Kingdom in the 1980s, where, you know, they were holding raves anywhere, but they were even holding them in abattoirs and things like that, whereas, you know, that, and that set off a law change where we didn't have that. We were able to kind of negotiate with people a little bit more, or sometimes use dock camps even, or things like that. But yeah, I think there was that growing awareness in the 2000s.
And I think now, like, we're at a really beautiful time where there's this movement of tino rangatiratanga that, I mean, hasn't started now, but is we're seeing more and more of it, which is really exciting, especially across the dance floor and at those events. Like, I'm sure you're aware, we just had our first all Māori lineup at Boiler Room in Tamaki Makaurau just this last weekend.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. I wasn't aware of that. Sorry, I've been a little bit head down, but that is absolutely brilliant to hear that. Yeah, that's awesome.
Cool. We've got a few songs to get through, so let's start with a song, and then we'll resume our corridor. Can you talk to me a little bit about this Shapeshifter track that we're going to listen to? It's such a classic.
Well, I was just sort of thinking when you contacted me yesterday, I was like, oh God, there's so many tracks I love. And I guess I've just been thinking a little bit about Shapeshifter in terms of, you know, I was there in Otatahi, I was writing for the Christchurch Press, as the music reviewer in the late 90s, and I was lucky enough to be a judge at the RDU Roundup Band competition.
Mm.
And that was the first time I heard Shapeshifter in, at the semi-finals.
Wow.
And I was blown away because I'd been going to the drum and bass gigs that were going off in Otatahi at that time. You know, like all the UK DJs were coming over and playing these 800, you know, a venue that held 800 people. And so I was really familiar with drum and bass. Obviously, you can't really be a music critic in that city at that time, not to be.
Mm.
And then when I saw and heard Shapeshifter and was watching Redford on the drums going, oh my God, he's playing that live, like just blown away. And I knew they were going to be huge. Ironically, they came second in the final of the band competition.
The underdog.
Well, I had a screaming argument with a good friend of mine who ran it because they didn't get any points for vocals, and I'm still miffed about this because they were instrumental at the time, and that's the only reason they didn't win was because they couldn't get 10 judges points for vocals, and they the organiser wouldn't kind of, you know, give them half things. So yeah, it's great hearing this from their first album.
Well, they got Lady Six on this one, so they get full marks for vocals here.
This is absolutely.
Move. This is Move With Me from Shapeshifter featuring Lady Six. Both of these artists, Shapeshifter and Lady Six, have such a, like we always talk about these artists having such a distinctively Aotearoa kind of sound. What role is, I mean, as you explain in your thesis, what kind of role is Land playing in creating that distinctive Aotearoa sound?
Well, I think for me, because my degree was actually in English literature, and so I studied New Zealand literature a lot, and the landscape is always central to literature, is always central to New Zealand film. Even television shows, it's always almost like an extra character in a television show often. And so, of course, our music is going to be influenced by it as well. And I think if there's a central sort of New Zealand character aspect, you know, how we feel about the landscape is really part of it. And so to me, it just made sense. And the more I listened to it, I have a really clear memory of being in the car in central Otago on the way to the Ripon Festival in the late 1990s. And I think I had the first Epsilon Blue album and one of my friends had the first Pitch Black album. And we kind of played them back to back. And I was just driving, right, you know, in the back seat looking, going, oh my God, what I am hearing outside is what I'm hearing inside. And that relates to Belter Space and HDU, bands that I already was really into and could hear the landscape in. So for me, it was just a progression of that kind of thinking. And then the more I sort of heard a lot of the electronic stuff coming out, and originally for my thesis, I was just going to argue about it with New Zealand music in general, but then realised I needed to narrow it down. And because the EDM scene was just going mental in that, you know, at the time of the new millennium, it just made sense for me to narrow it down to that particular, well, I won't say it's a genre, to that group of genres.
Beautiful. Yeah, so cool. I think we should jump straight into another track. I'm loving this. Should we listen to this Nomad tune?
Yes, definitely. I love this one.
Cool. Talk to me a little bit about this.
Well, Nomad was another one who was around in Otatahi at the same time as Shapeshifter. You know, and I mean, there was Tiki, there was Nomad, there was Salmonella Dub, Confucius. There was so many, you know, amazing artists at that time that we were really spoilt for choice. The thing I love about this track is it features Pearl Runga. And so she's not often known amongst the Runga sisters. I think she's the middle one. And I just felt like it was a really, it came off the album Movement, which was sort of, you know, such a it was, instead of Shapeshifter doing the live band drum and bass, Nomad was doing the more producer drum and bass, but also working with vocalists. And it just sort of captures that essence. And I tell you what, whenever I heard this track outside in the dance parties, my little soul would just, you know, go off on its own little journey with it, to the point that I used to just quite often, like, you know, actually be really uncool and ask Nomad to play it for me. So, yeah, I love this track.
Cool.
Thank you.
Those vocals are really beautiful.
Aren't they? I think she's singing with an 80s band now, but I always felt that, you know, those three sisters, yeah. Their voices are amazing.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. I think it's so special to be, you know, talking about this where the land and social context is so influential in the sound of our music, but then it all kind of comes back around again, and the music is often so influential in our social context. Like, I mean, exactly how festivals work, as well as, you know, in a more political sense as well, like with the hikoi and everything recently, I feel like music has played quite a big part in that. So it's very special to be reflecting on this.
Yeah, I mean, the hikoi, oh, I was just blown away last week watching the news about it and everything. And oh, I'm just, you know, feeling this real sense of, wow. You know, I've just been looking into the 1975 Land March.
Mm.
And that started with 50 people in Northland and ended up with 5,000 people in at Parliament. And it's like, wow, here we are all these years later. I mean, it's really sad that Māori have to march again like that. But, you know, to get, and I'm assuming it was around about 50,000 people from, you know, different things I've heard. It's like, wow, that's amazing that there's such a groundswell, and not just Māori, but Pākehā as well, who, you know, a lot of us do consider ourselves to be tangata te tiriti. So, you know, we want it honoured. Mm. We want te tiriti honoured, because that is the one that Māori signed. And so music has always had such an important part to play, especially in the genres in reggae and hip-hop. And, you know, even some of the alternative genres have had a lot to say politically in Aotearoa as well.
Mm. It just goes to show that it's so important to keep understanding that social context and the relevance of our music and where it has come from and how far it's been and everything, which I guess is demonstrated quite a lot by your most recent work, which is this new course at the University of Canterbury.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I taught it, I taught a version of it in the 2000s when I was doing my thesis. And then because I kind of gave up the going through people's trash for a living a couple of years ago when I realised it kind of made me lose the will to live. And I came back to, I was really lucky to be able to contact some of the lecturers I used to work with at Canterbury and say, hey, listen, are you looking for tutors?
Mm.
And luckily they were. And because I was back, I was lecturing for somebody this year, and it came through my emails that they were looking for summer school courses. And I thought, oh, is it time for me to revive my New Zealand music course? And they said yes. So it is CULT 133, C-U-L-T. And the joke I'm making is I'm not trying to start a cult. I have no interest in that. But it is for cultural studies. So it's a cultural studies course. It's summer school, so it's taught January 6th to February the 7th. It is 5 weeks, so it's very intense, but it is worth 15 points. So for anybody who, and we're teaching at distance as well, so you don't have to be in Canterbury, you don't have to come to campus. You can actually attend lectures live, or you can watch the recordings. I'll be doing a tutorial via Zoom with distance students. So I think the idea is that for people who maybe are coming to Canterbury in February anyway, they might want to get a little bit of a head start and do 15 points on a New Zealand music course over summer. Or for anybody who's just interested in whether they would like to do a little bit of university study, see what it's like, or, you know, anybody who maybe wants, not sure whether they want to do an arts subject, it would be a great introduction on whether or not you're going to enjoy arts, and I would say you probably are. I know I have a lot of students who quite often come to me and go, oh, you know, I'm only doing this as a this arts paper is a fun one, you know, with my business degree or whatever. And it's like, yeah, you can just do what you love and make a living out of it.
Totally.
But yeah, I think for anybody who's sort of, you don't have to know anything about local music, or you might know a lot. You might know more than I do. And I'm more than happy for people to bring that, because the assessment, I've sort of arranged it is that you'll be able to look at your own interests. So, you know, you'll be able to look at bands you like and artists you like and your essay and things like that. So I'm trying to make it as much fun, but we'll be looking at New Zealand music from the 1950s by genre. So each lecture will sort of be by genre, and it will relate back to something that was happening culturally and historically when that music first started kind of bubbling to the surface.
Hmm. I mean, looking at the description, it looks like the dream course for any audio culture nerd.
It really probably is. Yeah, I'm a little bit, I am a little bit concerned going, oh, do I want the audio culture nerds? Because they might know way more than me. I'd never get too worried about that. The way I see knowledge is if we all share knowledge, then we're all going to be better off. And I've always got plenty to learn as oh my God. Teaching this now as opposed to 20 years ago, there is so much available. In fact, I'm having panic attacks about what I have to leave out, and I'm having to narrow it down to really the artists and the songs that had a lot to say about that time, particularly with politics and things like that. I'm working on the hip-hop lecture this week, and every time I read something new or I have a look at something else, another artist pop up and I'm like, oh my God, I forgot about them. And you know, that's when it started to go really ballistic.
Gosh, only one lecture for hip hop. I feel for you, that's hard. Hip hop in New Zealand could be like a whole course in itself.
Yeah, and exactly. It is a 3-hour lecture, so at least I do have that going for me. I'm trying to mix it up that we play a lot of music, but we also play, particularly for the genres where, as a Pākehā, I want to make sure that other voices in mine are heard. So particularly reggae and hip hop and roots, I'm playing a lot of documentary as well, because there's so many amazing documentaries out there now, you know, that when I was teaching us in the 2000s, we just didn't have the technology for a lot of these things and I couldn't link to it. I used to spend hours in the video editing suite. And of course I don't have to do any of that now, but the difficulty is actually sifting through so much and working out what to focus on. I mean, I would love to, you know, you could basically do a whole degree in New Zealand music, let's face it, but I think as an introduction to both cultural studies and to Aotearoa music, this will just be a good little taster of things, really.
Very cool. Everybody can head to the University of Canterbury website and check out Cult 133, Kia Kaha, Say It Loud, The Rise of Aotearoa New Zealand Music. Great name for the course.
Yes, and I want to thank Upper Hutt Posse and particularly Word for giving me permission to use that name. I had to contact them and say, is it okay if I use this? Partly because I used Air 2, Stand Proud was the name of the course of the 2000s, so I sort of wanted to look at the progression of that as well.
Cool. And if you want to, of course, enrol in the course, and if you want extra for experts to study before the course begins, you can check out Sharon's thesis, which is still, as we've found, very relevant and very important. Wave Shape Conversion, The Land is Reverent, and the Dance Culture and Music of Aotearoa.
Yes.
We're currently listening to We Be Moving, Epsilon Blue and Barnaby Ware. I think we'll just play this one out as we say ka kite.
Well, ka kite anō, and thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sharon. Have a good rest of your evening.
You too. Thank you.
Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just fascination.